Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, April 8, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Teleforum conference call on intellectual property in the Supreme Court. My name is Katie McClendon. I'm the Director of Publications at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also note that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today we welcome a few experts. I will first welcome Professor Dennis D. Crouch, co-director in the Center for Intellectual Property and Entrepreneurship and associate professor of law at the University of Missouri School of Law. He will be our moderator today, and he'll introduce our other two speakers. So thank you for joining us today, Professor Crouch. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Katie. I'm coming at you from sunny Missouri, and as Katie mentioned, here at the University of Missouri School of Law, we have, in addition to active protests at the University of Missouri, we also have our thriving Center for Intellectual Property and Entrepreneurship Law. I wanted to thank the Federalist Society for hosting this, and especially Katie McClendon for organizing the event and running the show. This term, the Supreme Court has already granted five petitions for writ of certiorari in intellectual property cases. About 35 petitions still remain pending. These figures are above the court's average if we look back over the past several decades, but they are lower than a few of the high points that we've seen in the past few years. Our plan here, we're going to spend a few minutes presenting each of the cases where cert has been granted, but we also want to allow time for questions and participation from the audience and from members of the panel. Now, we've really got an amazing panel. Our two speakers here are first rate. Our first speaker, Gerard Beeney. Mr. Beeney is the co-head of Sullivan and Cromwell's IP and Technology Group. He's one of the top trial lawyers in the country and regularly handles a variety of cases, including IP, licensing, and antitrust cases. Mr. Beeney, on point for today's discussion, is co-counsel of two of the pending Supreme Court patent cases, the Stryker case, as well as Quozzo, as I call it, or there's the Italian version of Quazzo. Our second speaker is Matthew Hellman. Mr. Hellman is a top appellate and Supreme Court advocate. He's a partner with Jenner and Block. He followed in Barack Obama's footsteps as president of the Harvard Law Review. He was later a clerk, Supreme Court Justice David Souter. And like Mr. Beeney, Mr. Hellman has a tie to the IP cases at issue today. Mr. Hellman is co-counsel for the pending Supreme Court case of Kurt Zhang versus John Wiley and Sons. I thought we'd start with Mr. Beeney talking about a couple of the patent cases.
Thanks very much, Dennis, and thanks to the Society for inviting me, and good afternoon to everyone. I and my colleague at Sullivan & Cromwell, Jeff Wall, are honored to be counsel in two of the cases the court has granted cert this term, as Dennis mentioned, Stryker and Quozzo. The Stryker case involves the question of when should the court, after a finding of infringement and a finding of invalidity not having been proven, when should the court award enhanced damages? The question in Quozzo is the appropriate standard for construing claims in inter partes review, a new procedure that the Congress set up to allow for challenges under Sections 102 and 103 of the Patent Act based on certain written publications. I'll try to be brief and go through a couple of the issues in the case, and also try to be as, I guess, as even-handed as I'm capable of being, given the fact that we're counsel on the matter. Let me start with Stryker, which was argued on February 23rd, and kind of give a little background to that. Stryker was consolidated with a second case raising the identical question, a case referred to as HALO. And that question is basically how to apply the very simple language of Section 284 of the Patent Act that, quote, after a finding of infringement and an award of damages, quote, the court may increase damages up to 3 times the amount found or assessed. And the statute provides no further guidance. Briefly on the facts, in Stryker, a competitor of Stryker's basically copied a patented device that's used during surgery to clean bone surfaces and continued to sell that device notwithstanding Stryker's warning letters and even notwithstanding a district court's summary judgment determination that one of the patents in suit was infringed. The rest of the case went to trial, and the jury found that the defendant had not shown that the patents were invalid and that Stryker had shown infringement. In post-trial briefing, the district court found that this was not a close case, that there had been clear infringement, and that the two-part test that the Federal Circuit had set for the awarding of enhanced damages in a case that we all refer to as Seagate had been met, and the district court trebled the $70 million actual damages award that came out of the jury. Stryker appealed, and the Federal Circuit reviewed the district court's determination under Section 284 de novo and reversed, finding that the defendant in Stryker had raised a defense that was objectively, or at least not objectively, unreasonable, and therefore the Seagate test had not been met. Just again, briefly, although enhanced damages have been around since the 19th century, it wasn't until Seagate that the Federal Circuit set a what at least we referred to before the court as a rigid standard, finding that in order to meet and award damages under Section 284, there had to be clear and convincing evidence that the infringer acted despite an objectively high likelihood that its conduct was infringing, and second, that the infringer has or should have known, knew or should have known, of the risk of infringement. As you may imagine, we argued in the court that there was no support in the relatively simple language of Section 284 for the Seagate test. Particularly, we argued that a district court's discretion is implicated by the statute and that review should not be de novo, but review should be for abuse of discretion. Second, that there was nothing in the statute that suggested that there ought to be anything other than the typical preponderance of the evidence standard. And third, that there was no reason for the rigid Seagate test, and in particular, no reason why a defendant who may have engaged in egregious conduct up until the time that it was sued should necessarily escape enhanced damages because it hired good counsel to come up with a defense at that point in time that was not objectively unreasonable. Interestingly, the Patent and Trademark Office appeared as amicus in support of our position, and the case was basically argued on those grounds. Again, mindful of the time and trying to be brief, I think based on the argument, I would probably make three predictions. One, I think the Seagate test will fall. I don't think that the respondents were able to convince the court that Seagate either was justified under the plain language of Section 284 or that Seagate appropriately advanced the goals of the statute. I think it's a little unclear as to what the court will do to replace the Seagate test. On the one hand, the discretion that the statute seems to suggest for the district court is really quite broad. Several of the justices were concerned with the breadth of leaving it simply up to the district courts to apply the totality of the circumstances and determine whether damages should be enhanced. So it may very well be that the court will adopt some of the language that the PTO suggested and make plain that the place for 284 in our patent jurisprudence is truly reserved for unusually egregious conduct and not conduct that is merely negligent. And that was also a line that we tried to walk, aware of the concern that we expected the court would have in giving yet another tool to the much criticized litigious efforts of certain patent owners that really engage in stick-up efforts to bring people to perhaps settlements that otherwise would not be justified but for the threat of litigation. I hesitate to use the non-practicing entity or troll label because basically as a matter of a principle, I don't think that accurately describes the problem that we all face in the patent world. I think it's more the conduct rather than the nature of the patent owner. Second prediction, I do think that the court will reject the de novo review standard of the district court's awarding of enhanced damages, and I also think that the court will reject the idea that proof required to get enhancement of damages needs to be by clear and convincing evidence. So with that, let me now quickly try to shift over to Quozo, a case in which we are actually on the other side of the Patent and Trademark Office. Two issues were granted cert in that case. One, as I mentioned, was the correct claim interpretation standard for inter partes review. And the second is whether this newly created board under the 2011 America Invents Act called the Patent Trademark and Appeal Board, or the board, whether its decision to institute inter partes review in response to a third party's petition, as opposed to its final decision as to whether a patent is valid or not or patentable or not, whether the institution decision is subject to judicial appellate review, and that's the second question that will be argued on April 25th. Just to take a step back to put the issue in a little bit of context, as you probably know, in 2011, Congress made the most sweeping changes to the Patent Act since the 1950s. Among other things, it created three new proceedings within the Patent and Trademark Office to adjudicate the validity or patentability of patents under certain conditions, and one of those was something called inter partes review, which replaced the old inter partes reexamination process. The IPR is a process to challenge novelty or obviousness based on a class of written documents. It is, in our view, very court-like, and in fact, the legislative history and the Patent Office itself acknowledges that inter partes review was meant to be a cost-efficient substitute for district court litigation. The inter partes review process begins with a petition. There's a response by the patent owner. The board then decides whether to institute review. There is evidence, affidavits, expert affidavits and declarations, discovery, hearing, and then ultimately a final decision. In the early rulemaking for inter partes review, the Patent and Trademark Office decided to use to interpret claims the broadest reasonable claim construction, or BRI, to compare those claims to the prior art that had been or has been identified by the petitioner. The Patent and Trademark Office justified the use of that standard largely on the grounds that that's the standard that it had used before for 100 years. in examinational proceedings. In the Quazzo case itself, the board used the BRI standard to invalidate Quazzo's claims and to refuse to allow substituted claims on the ground that the substituted claims added new material that were not supported in the specification of the patent. Our position in the brief that we filed, and as we will argue, our reply brief will be in about 10 days, is that the American Invents Act, as everyone acknowledges, converted an examinational proceeding into an adjudicatory proceeding, and that therefore IPR is inappropriate. BRI is inappropriate. The BRI claim construction is used in the examination context in an iterative process back and forth between the examiner and the applicant to clarify claim language, to make sure that ambiguous claim language does not lead to overbroad constructions, whereas the objective of IPR is really quite different. It's to determine the patentability of claims under Sections 102 and 103, and therefore it's our view that the invention should be construed in that context to be what it is, and that, as the Federal Circuit recently said, the claim should not be construed broadly to encompass prior art that otherwise would be distinguishable if the claims were given their actual meanings. Again, briefly on the appeal issue, there is language in the statute in which Congress suggested that at least parts of the board's determination is final and non-reviewable. It's our view that in light of the presumption that agency actions are reviewable in the courts, that any ambiguity in that act, in that statute needs to be construed in favor of reviewability, that the statute meant to eliminate reviews of the determination by the director of the patent office that a standard for institution had been met, that is, that the petitioner has shown it's likely to prevail on at least one of its assertions, but not whether the board had met all of the other, had decided correctly all of the other requirements that a petitioner must meet in order to have inter partes review instituted. And so basically the argument on that point will be how clear is it that Congress intended that the entirety of the institution decision was not subject to review, and if there is ambiguity, whether the presumption of reviewability in the court should hold. So I think ultimately at the end of the day, we'll see how the argument goes, of course, but we do really, I think, firmly believe that BRI certainly has its place in the examinational context, but it really is a fish out of water in the adjudicatory context, which is certainly what Congress intended in the IPR process. So that's a bit of a background. Happy to add some more details as we get into some questions, but I certainly wanted to reserve time for my colleagues on the panel, as well as to make sure that we had time for questions. And so that's kind of a brief summary of what those cases are about.
Cool. Thanks, Gerard. I think that was really helpful. I think what I'd like to do is before we start questioning you, actually let Mr. Hellman come in with a couple more cases before we open things up. Matt, are you ready?
Yes, I am. Thank you so much, and thanks very much to the Society for having me here today. It's an honor to be on the panel. And as Dennis began by saying, I'm going to talk about two cases where cert has been granted. The first is Samsung v. Apple, and the second is Kurtzsang v. John Wiley. Now, given that I'm co-counsel in the Wiley case, and I believe we had counsel for the other two cases on the phone, Samsung v. Apple is the only one that we're going to be discussing today where I believe none of us is counsel, so this is probably the only fair-minded recitation that you're going to get, including what I'll end up saying on Kurtzsang too. So with Samsung v. Apple, this is, I guess you could say, it's the latest chapter in the long-running litigation between the two smartphone giants that we have in this country. And the issue in this case is the measure of damages for the infringement of design patents. A jury had found that Samsung had infringed three of Apple's design patents on its not today current, older generation of smartphones. And actually, this is, you know, I wish that we had a way to show you a picture in giving the presentation, because I think it would be worth a thousand words. But, if, you know, you might want to pull out your own smartphone, because I think the design patents we'll be talking about will have some resonance even with today's phones. What Apple had sued over were design patents on three aspects. One was the black rectangular front face with round corners of the iPhone at that time, a similar face with a bezel or surrounding rim, or basically a raised curved rectangular edge that went around the phone, and then also what seems to be called the colorful grid of 16 icons that you see when you go to the home screen on an Apple phone. And so, you know, if one pulls out one's phone today, I think there's at least recognizable elements even today, both on the Apple product as well as the Samsung. Well, a jury apparently agreed and awarded Apple over $1 billion in damages for the infringement of design patents. And then on appeal, that got knocked down to $548 million in the Federal Circuit. And what these damages reflected were the, and this is the key point for the case, the entirety of Samsung's profits from selling these infringing phones. And it's that entirety of its profits that's the basis of the issue the court will hear next year. Design patent damages are governed by a pretty venerable statute, 35 U.S.C. 289, which says in relevant part that whoever sells any item to which a design has been implied shall be liable to the owner to the extent of, quote, his total profit. And for quite some time now, the Federal Circuit test has focused on total profit and has held that that means all the profits from the infringing good or damages, not just those that are traceable or apportionable to the infringing design. And Samsung has argued in a cert petition that's now been granted that this leads to ridiculous results. And it's not too hard to think of examples that do seem a little ridiculous. You know, imagine that you invent a nifty cup holder design and get a patent on it, and Ford copies that cup holder and puts it in its Lincoln Navigator. If that's an infringement of your design patent, then in theory, under this test, Ford would have to give up all the profits it made from that $50,000 Lincoln Navigator just because it used a cup holder that was infringing, even though, let's just stipulate that no one bought the Navigator because of the cup holder, despite the cleverness of the design. You can imagine other examples. You know, I think this would be fair to say that if the remote control for a fancy television you know, has a design patent on it, then perhaps all the profits from selling that TV could be disgorged. Now, so Samsung says the right way to think about this is to separate out the profits that the infringer obtained through using the design, not just all the total profits. And what I think will, you know, Apple has some responses to this, as did the Federal Circuit as well. The Federal Circuit said in response to this argument about absurdity that it's better addressed to Congress than to the courts. And there's some history there that somewhat bears that out. Congress adopted this total profit language, at least in the aftermath of decisions that had awarded very small damages for the infringement of design patents, something like 6 cents on the dollar. Now, admittedly, the designs or the products in question there were entirely ornamental products like wallpaper or rugs, where, you know, much of the utility, if not all of it, comes from the design and not other features. But nonetheless, that's the language that Congress used, and it's been in place ever since. And there have been at least a few cases that have presented fact patterns that present something of a common sense challenge to that language, and Congress hasn't changed it. So perhaps the application is better addressed to Congress, not the courts. And Apple also points out that it would be hard in many cases to isolate those profits that are due to the infringing design, which I suppose is probably true, although the law tolerates that type of difficult inquiry in lots of other areas. So that's something the court will have to figure out as well. But in terms of predictions, I think it's quite early to make any predictions. We haven't even seen the merits briefs from the parties yet. But in general, when the Federal Circuit's tests have been taken up for review, it hasn't augured well for the respondent in those cases. But I suppose maybe when we have this panel next year, we'll talk about what the court did and did not do with respect to it. I'll turn to Kurt Tsang now, as we're moving towards the halfway point of the hour. And so the second case I'd like to talk about is Kurt Tsang v. John Wiley. And if that name rings a bell, it's because it's really the second time this case has come to the court in recent years. The first time it reached the court was about the merits of the copyright issue in the case. And this time, the second time, it's about the standard for attorney's fees for the prevailing party. And attorney's fees have been a hot issue in IP circles recently. So we certainly care about the Kurt Tsang case here, and we expect it will get some substantial attention in the IP community more generally. So the underlying dispute in Kurt Tsang was the following. John Wiley is a textbook publisher, and John Wiley is our client, I should point out. And they publish, or at least did publish, English language textbooks made of cheaper materials and sold for a lower price in foreign countries like Thailand. And they were identical in content to the English, or largely identical in content to the U.S. versions, but made more cheaply and therefore able to be sold more cheaply to meet the market considerations in foreign markets. Kurt Tsang, and it was an individual, would take those textbooks from Thailand, bring them to the United States, essentially sell them at a higher price than what he paid for them in Thailand, but albeit lower than the price of the higher quality U.S. version. So essentially he had an arbitrage business going, and it was, by all accounts, successful with over $1 million in sales. And the question was that copyright infringement? John Wiley sued and alleging infringement, and there were really two competing provisions of copyright law that would govern whether or not that was infringement. One provision gave the copyright owner the exclusive right to import into this country, and another gave lawful buyers the right to dispose of works that they purchased. When you buy a book from Amazon, you could sell it to your used bookstore in this country anyway without violating copyright. The Supreme Court had actually deadlocked 4-4 on this merits question the first time it dealt with it in the Costco case. And John Wiley had sued in the Southern District of New York, prevailed itself on the question, and then had the Second Circuit affirm just as the Supreme Court was deadlocking 4-4. And then the Supreme Court ultimately heard the case in John Wiley and reversed on a 6-3 judgment. That was Wiley number one. Back down to the district court, and Kurt Tsang's lawyers at ORIC filed a fee petition as a prevailing party seeking $2 million in fees for the work they had done in the Supreme Court, work that, as the record showed, Kurt Tsang himself was not obligated to pay for. The fee arrangement between ORIC and Kurt Tsang was that so long as ORIC got to do the argument, ORIC wouldn't charge Kurt Tsang for any of the fees that it generated or would have otherwise have generated. The district court denied the fee application, and it did so under the Second Circuit's test for fees under the Copyright Act, which basically says the following. You give substantial weight to whether or not the losing party's position was reasonable, and you look at any other factor that might bear on whether or not fees should be awarded. So the district court did that. It said, of course, Wiley's position was reasonable. The Supreme Court had deadlocked on it before, and it was still the subject of a split decision, and they had prevailed in the Second Circuit. So clearly it was a reasonable position, even if it was ultimately unsuccessful. And then it went on to discuss other considerations that might have, nonetheless counsel in favor of awarding fees. Was there a need to compensate Kurt Tsang? No, there wasn't. He had his arbitrage business now and wasn't on the hook for the fees anyway that his lawyers were seeking, and nor was there any other consideration that warranted the award of fees. The Second Circuit affirmed, and the Supreme Court granted cert again, and the theory in the cert petition and in Kurt Tsang's merits brief is that the Second Circuit is wrong to use a test for determining whether or not fees are warranted that gives substantial weight to the reasonableness of the losing party's position. Kurtzsang says that that is inconsistent and does not further the goals of the Copyright Act. And Kurtzsang's position instead is that really the predominant consideration ought to be the importance of the issue. If it's an important issue that the courts decide, then fees generally should be awarded, or at least in the ordinary case, should be awarded to the prevailing party. We've now filed our red brief in response to that, and I think we'll be seeing the Kurtzsang reply brief in the next couple weeks or so. And we make a few points in our respondents' brief, which we think are persuasive and certainly hope the court agrees. The first is that objective reasonableness has been sort of at the heart of fee determinations under the 1909 Copyright Act and then also under the 76 Act, which had exactly the same language for awarding fees, which basically just leaves it to the discretion of the district court. So we say objective reasonableness has been at the heart of things for a long time. And the second point that we emphasize is what relatively little case law there is in the area from the Supreme Court emphasizes that fees ought to be awarded to where doing so would encourage parties to clarify the law. And our position is that when you essentially punish a party for taking a position in a close case that turns out to be wrong, they'll be less likely to litigate those close cases to judgment and on appeal where they have the greatest precedential effect. So if the goal of copyright law is to clarify the law so that authors and users of works alike can know what is and what is not permitted, then you don't want to put fees out there because it will disincentivize those parties to litigate. It's a little bit like the British rule, which is pretty well shown. The British rule says that the loser pays the fees of the winner in every case. And law and economics folks have shown pretty conclusively that makes you less likely to litigate a close case because you may not win, and then you're going to end up having to pay the fees of the winner if you turn out to be reasonable but nonetheless wrong. And so we discuss a few other considerations in the brief. We talk about whether or not the importance of the issue ought to be given primary weight, and we raise a couple points about why that doesn't seem like such a good idea to us. It's definitely hard for courts to figure out what is or is not an important issue. They may know what is or is not a reasonable position, but an important case really may not manifest itself for quite some time. And the other thing is that looking to the importance really seems, again, to have this perverse consequence that the more the law would benefit from being clarified, the less likely somebody will be willing to invest the time and energy to clarify it if they know they're going to have to pay the fees if their, again, reasonable but wrong position turns out not to prevail. So that case will be argued in April. My colleague Paul Smith, chair of our appellate group at Jenner, will be arguing it. And we'll see the reply brief in the next week or so. And we'll look forward to a decision before the court breaks for its summer recess.
Really interesting, Mr. Hellman. That's great. I want to announce to the audience we're going to open things up to questions, but I thought I would jump in and get started, and maybe thinking about this Quozo case, Gerard. You mentioned the statute. The statute says that the Patent Office's decision on whether or not to institute one of these IPR proceedings to cancel a patent, that decision shall be, quote, final and non-appealable. And your case really raises the question, okay, but is it really never appealable? To me, that raises a potential divide on the court, an ideological divide regarding separation of powers. And there's some at least scholars like Yale professor Akil Amar kind of takes a weak view of separation of powers, while there's many others that take a much stronger view. And I just wonder, and I don't know if you are going to be able to talk on this, but it seems like this is a potential area where we could see a split court and where the untimely death of Justice Scalia could have an impact on this ideological issue, where I think, in my view at least, as several of the other cases, I think are more likely to be unanimous or close to unanimous.
I think that's a very interesting and good point, Dennis, and I think you are correct, because the basic issue on this question of appealability really does come down to the issue that you've addressed, because on the one hand, you have what is in the abstract, if you take it out of the context in which it is embedded in the statute, relatively clear language. You know, final and non-appealable sounds pretty final and non-appealable. But I think you have to start in a place, if you believe that agency actions should be reviewed, with a place where the majority below did not start, which is the Administrative Procedures Act, which talks about the presumption in the cases under the Administrative Procedures Act, which talks about the presumption of reviewability, and then you put the statute into its context in which it arises in the American Invents Act. And I think when you put those together, you've got an argument that at best it's ambiguous what Congress intended. We would argue that it's relatively clear that the language had a limited intent, and that therefore certain parts of that institution decision should be reviewable. But I think you're absolutely correct that where you come out on that analysis is going to be informed by the place that you see the Patent and Trademark Office fitting into our system of jurisprudence and the role that you see of the courts. Obviously, that's not something that we have briefed or that I'm likely to argue on the 25th, but I think people's perspective on how they approach this issue, as I tried to articulate it, really will come down to, you know, where people see the role of the agency and the courts, and for that matter, how offended one is by what I think, not just in our case, but in several other cases, with due respect to the board, have clearly been ultra vires acts in instituting review. And I think you're quite right that you could very easily see a split along ideological positions, and end up with a split decision on that issue.
Yeah, and just to follow up, so we have this one case pending, and just for our audience to know, there's at least six pending petitions on different issues challenging aspects of these proceedings. At least some of them say that this form of litigation before an agency so offends our separation of powers tradition that it should be completely dismantled by the Supreme Court, and there's others that take kind of smaller chunks, and so I suspect that although this is an important case here, these challengers are going to continue, especially as it looks like at least a third of patent litigation now is taking place before the Patent Office, as opposed to in courts. Where 2 years ago, 100% was before the courts. Katie, I'm going to keep asking questions, but at some point, if you cut in with audience members, I'm happy to permit that as well.
It's up to you. Let me know when you'd like to open it up.
Okay, and so I think I wanted to go in with Mr. Hellman's discussion of Apple v. Samsung, which my perspective on this, my perspective is that the statute is clear that this entire amount of damages, that is the entire profits, that's what the statute is pretty clear that it says.
And so, putting Samsung at risk for this entire $600 million award. And the hard part here is that it's in contemporary patent law and intellectual property law, it's a pretty ridiculous statute. And in particular, it makes design patents, which are traditionally thought of as weak and very minor innovations, things that are not, right, you can't get a copyright on these things, and you can't sure. get a utility patent, but yet they have the most powerful damages statute. So in a big way, it'll be curious to see if the Supreme Court is tempted by these kind of strong policy reasons to essentially eliminate it, or are they going to be able to follow what the Federal Circuit did to say the statute is the statute and let's follow the statute?
You know, I think that's right. It's and certainly the Federal Circuit was sticking to its guns, saying this is if you think it's absurd, if you think it's outmoded, that's an argument to Congress, not to this court. But the statute isn't. There are, I think, respectable. I would maybe not the best, but nonetheless respectable textual arguments in favor of the petitioner's position. I mean, what it says is, whoever applies the patented design to any article of manufacture for the purpose of sale or exposes it for sale shall be liable to the owner to the extent of his total profit. And there's at least, I think, some room to say, well, total profit from what? Is it from the application, or is it for the total profit for the, of the sale of the item as a whole? On a blank slate, I think Apple does have the superior reading of the language, but if one put together more tools of statutory construction than just plain text, I think a respectable decision could be read or written to support the petitioner's position as well on this one.
That's a good point. Katie, do we have a question from the audience?
I'll open the floor to questions.
Okay.
In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then pound on your telephone.
As we're waiting there, okay.
Sorry about that.
Oh, no problem. As we're waiting, I'll just make one other comment on this Halo v. Stryker, which I think that Mr. Beeny is going to win this case. And for me, it follows kind of a general theme that's happened in a number of Supreme Court cases where the Federal Circuit, who is in a big way a patent-focused court, has made a very specific patent-focused rule put in place, and just like the Supreme Court did in KSR and another case Nautilus and in eBay and in MedImmune and in several other cases, I think the Supreme Court's going to basically pull this back and say, well, Federal Circuit, your rule is too tight, too harsh, and doesn't follow either the statute or our old tradition. And so pull things back, and I suspect that's going to be the outcome pretty soon in that case.
We have a couple of questions lined up. Is it all right if we go to some of those?
Yeah, let's go ahead.
Okay. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may go ahead and ask your question. We'll answer questions in the order in which they're received.
I have a question about what the textual support is for the party's position in the Kurtzang case.
Sure. And I was thinking as I was discussing the case, I didn't really quote the section of the Copyright Act that governs fee awards, and I have my brief right here so I can read it aloud. Section 505 of the Copyright Act provides that the court may award a reasonable attorney's fee to the prevailing party as part of the costs. That's all it says. And that language is taken almost verbatim from the 1909 Act as well. And so in terms of, you know, grounding in the text is relatively unconstrained, I suppose, in what it says to do. And that's one reason why we think it, the Second Circuit and the courts within it don't abuse their discretion when they say, we'll give substantial weight to the reasonableness of the party's position while looking at everything else. The Supreme Court, in a decision called Fogarty versus Fantasy, put a little bit of gloss on what this language meant. It said you have to, you know, you have to treat prevailing plaintiffs and prevailing defendants equally. This doesn't create a British rule in which fees are presumptively available to every prevailing party. And instead, really what you should do is award fees where it would be consistent with the Copyright Act's goals to do so. And that's where we say the goal of the Copyright Act, as identified by Fogarty, among other things, is to make sure the law is clear. And we think that, you know, awarding fees where someone's taking an unreasonable position furthers that goal, and not awarding fees where a losing party has taken a reasonable position also furthers that goal. So I hopefully that's responsive to your question.
Let's go to our next question.
I don't know if we let people follow up anyway.
I have a question regarding the Quozo case. I recently received an IPR decision that says, under the broadest reasonable interpretation standard, the claim terms are given their ordinary and customary meaning, as would be understood by one of ordinary skill in the art in the context of the entire disclosure. And then the Phillips case says, the words of a claim are generally given their ordinary and customary meaning, and that meaning is the meaning that the term would have to a person of ordinary skill in the art at the time of the invention. So my question is, what is the difference between the two standards? When would you see a difference in the result under the two different standards?
That's a very good question, and it's one that I'm expecting, you know, from the bench on the 25th. The answer, which is somewhat different than the one that I may give on the 25th, to put it in some context, is that it seems like, you know, truly one of the problems with broadest reasonable is that it really is subjective, and what the difference is between broadest reasonable and Phillips ordinary meaning often is in the eye of the beholder. So you do have you know, pronouncements by the Patent Office that on the one hand they do not limit themselves to the claim language, and that the standard that they use is different than the Phillips ordinary or actual meaning test. But if you look at, for example, the manual for examination, section, I think it's 2111, they also tie it, the BRI test, to many of the tools that Phillips enunciated for the plain actual meaning test.
Yes.
So I think the bottom line is that there is a difference which the Federal Circuit and PPC Broadband said can frequently be outcome determinative, and in fact in that case they gave a Phillips construction and they gave a BRI construction, and said under BRI, the patent's not patentable. Under Phillips, the patent is not invalid, to show how outcome determinative these two standards can be. But I think at the end of the day, the BRI, you know, does follow the words of the claim, looks at the specification, takes into account the patentee's lexicography, if you will, but yet at the same time then puts itself in the eyes of one of ordinary skill in the art and says, well, how broadly might I construe this? Notwithstanding what the inventor may have intended, and that seems to me to be perfectly appropriate in the examinational context to try to make sure that there's no ambiguity in the claim language, but completely inappropriate when one should be trying to determine the scope of an invention to see if it's got 102 or 103 problems. And so I think at bottom, that's a long-winded answer, as that's the difference. There is a difference, and it can be frequently outcome determinative as to whether the patent survives.
You know, this is Dennis Crouch, and I wanted to add to that I agree with the questioner that it is really hard to determine what is the difference. And for me, the big problem is that there are two different standards. The theory behind BRI is that it's supposed to be broader, but there are actually many cases where we've seen that a court interprets the claim term broader than we would have expected the patent office to, and so it's not always the case. For me, the problem is that when they're different, that actually has given the patent office the excuse, and as well as courts, the excuse of not following the decisions of this other adjudicatory body. And so when these cases go back before the patent office, they can completely ignore everything that the courts have already decided in the case because they're using a different standard. And likewise, when it goes to court, they can ignore what the patent office said because it's a different standard. And for me, that creates a problem and ambiguity in the system. And so I don't really care which standard they use, but I would like for them to pick one standard that's uniform.
Yes, that certainly is one of the problems with the dual standards, and you know, as you say, and as some of the amicus have said, of which there are more than 30 in this case, it just makes no sense to have one invention mean different things depending upon the forum that you're in, and have one invention be unpatentable in light of a set of prior art, and have it be not invalid in light of the same set of prior art, which is not just apocryphal. You know, there are, I don't know, a dozen or so cases in which that has actually happened.
Yes, but I might add...
I'm sorry about that. I think I might have cut off our caller. If you want to finish your question, you can press star and then pound. Again, and as same to the rest of our audience, if you'd like to ask a question, press star and then pound on your telephone. Dennis, we don't have any other questions lined up, so if you have another question you'd like to discuss, please go ahead.
Thanks so much. I wanted to mention, you know, so I mentioned in the introduction that we have a number of pending petitions for certiorari, and I just thought I might mention a couple that I think have a good likelihood of being granted, or at least are quite important. One of them is a case called Sequinom, and it relates to what I think is the biggest turmoil in the patent system over the past few years, which comes from the Supreme Court's kind of expansive jurisprudence over patent eligibility. We've had the Alice Corp case revolving abstract ideas and Mayo v. Prometheus involving laws of nature and natural phenomena. This new case, Sequinom, looks to, the patentee is hoping to get the Supreme Court to essentially say that it went too far in Mayo. That is to shrink these exceptions to eligibility. And I think that this is a kind of good case for patentees because it's a really impressive invention involving a way to obtain fetal DNA while not having to actually stick a needle through a placenta. But the courts have ruled that that the test that's being claimed is really is effectively claiming a law of nature and therefore is unpatentable. So petition's been filed there. I think that we'll see some amount of support. for it and an important case, although whether or not the Supreme Court grants cert, I think, goes back to something that Matt Hellman mentioned. That is, when since the Federal Circuit is the only patent appellate court these days, when the Supreme Court grants cert on a Federal Circuit decision, it's usually to change the law of what the Federal Circuit did, as opposed to resolving a circuit split. So if we see a grant of cert in the Sequinom case, I would suspect the outcome is going to be a narrowing of the exceptions, that is make it easier to patent things like diagnostic tests and personalized medicine. And although this isn't a software case, I think the folks who are wanting to patent software will hope that this case will have language that favors them as well. The second case I just wanted to mention is one called Lexmark versus Impression Products. And Lexmark, this is a case involving the refilling of printer ink cartridges, which that kind of secondary market is a big business. And the two key holdings from the Federal Circuit in this case is one, that foreign sales, right, that Lexmark's foreign sales are presumed not to exhaust the U.S. patent rights. That is, so that if somebody has a patented product and they sell it abroad, they can then, when the buyers try to import it into the U.S., the patentee can block that and essentially collect twice on the patent revenue. The second holding is the patentee is permitted to place use restrictions on the product at the point of retail sale that then binds subsequent purchasers of the product. I come at this, I teach intellectual property and internet law, but I also teach our 1L property course. And these kind of use and resale restraints on chattel are the type of restraints that normally the law wouldn't enforce, but the Federal Circuit says we are going to enforce them because of patent rights. And so I think it'd be really interesting if the court took this, but there are really good policy arguments, I think, on both sides.
Let's go to our next caller. Remember, for the rest of our audience, press star and pound to ask a question.
Hi, Marianne McGrail, an attorney in D.C. I was particularly interested in the observation of the shift from the courts to the PTO of cases. It's a sizable shift. I was wondering what you think the reason for that is and what the consequences are.
So this is Dennis, and so I'll speak to this, and Mr. B may jump in as well. But the basic thing that happened is, as Gerard mentioned, in 2011, Congress passed what's called the America Invents Act. It took a few years to be implemented, but it basically implemented, right, the Patent Office, through being empowered by this new law, has implemented a set of mechanisms for third parties to effectively challenge patent rights through the Patent Office. Which, as opposed to the old system where the only real effective mechanism was to go to court. Congress implemented this law for a number of reasons. One is there was much discussion about a large number of issued patents actually being ones that would be invalidated if they were ever challenged, but we also had all kinds of evidence about how expensive it was for somebody to challenge a patent in court. That is, just getting to a jury verdict, folks are hard-pressed to spend less than $1 million on attorney and expert fees. So these new, more streamlined systems were created largely as alternative mechanisms for opposing and canceling patent claims, and they've turned out that they are effective. That is, lots of the challenged patents have had substantial number of their claims canceled, and they have also been found to be relatively cost effective. So we're talking about costing hundreds of thousands of dollars to cancel a patent claim as opposed to more than a million. And so although it's still expensive, it's much cheaper than the old system. And those have led to its popularity. And so we've seen that shift. Does that answer that question?
Yes, it does. So overall, it's a positive move in your view. The America Invents Act has been had a positive effect.
There are a number of other changes with the America Invents Act, but I absolutely agree that when we have what you would call bad patents out there, ones that never should have issued, that are covering, you know, something that's invalid, we should have a cost-effective mechanism for getting rid of that. And I think that this is a big step in that direction. And so I applaud it for that. I do think there are a number of problems, and some of the amici who filed in support of Quozo have argued that essentially the patent office is going too far, that really the patentee, no matter if they have a good patent or not, doesn't survive a challenge. And there's some legitimacy in my view to that. And so perhaps we've gone too far. At the same time, though, we've also seen a change in courts over the past couple of years where there's a substantial increase of judgments on the pleadings and quick summary judgments by courts. And when you count those in, these court challenges have also become cheaper. And it's unclear, right? Part of this is a competitive process where both sides want to prove that they're doing the right thing. And part of it is changes in the law making it easier to challenge.
Thank you.
Dennis, just to add a couple things to that, to take one view rather than a kind of expressed my view, which is a little bit more nuanced and balanced, I think some people would say that this is really, the IPR process is a beast that is feeding itself. The former chief judge of the Federal Circuit, I think, called the IPR process and the board that implements it the death squad. Current statistics are that it institutes review in about 70% of the time, and in 70% of those cases in which it institutes review, it cancels all of the claims that are subject to the review. And those statistics are smaller percentages now than they were earlier. So the success of canceling claims has caused the number of petitions to skyrocket. And just one other point that I'd make is that unlike district courts where someone actually has to have a case or controversy, in the IPR process, you don't need to have that. Any third party can file a petition to cancel a claim, including what has happened here, organizations that take fees from people who may be subject to patent claims, and they go out and they pick claims that they would like to try to cancel and file IPRs, regardless of whether they have any risk that patent is ever going to be asserted against them. We have hedge fund managers who sell a company short and then file an IPR to try to cancel its claims, not because they've got any concern about the patent system or the validity or any fear that they're going to be facing a claim of infringement, but because they've got a financial interest in seeing the stock price of the patent owner go down. And I do think that, you know, our inventive system has served our economy exceptionally well over the last 200 years, and I really do think, and now this is my view, not just a patentee's view, that this system has gone far over the edge in terms of denigrating the value of intellectual property, disincentivizing research and development, and causing confusion as to the scope of patent rights when they mean one thing in IPR and they mean a different thing in the district court.
Thank you.
We We are at the end of our time, but we have one more question. Would you like to go to the question, or should we wrap up?
Let's do this one more, and then we'll stop, if that's fine.
All right, sure. Last question, and we'll make it quick.
Hey, this question is for Dennis. I'm Eli Sheets. I'm an attorney in the Raleigh area here. Do mostly patent work, but I just wondered your thoughts on whether the court is likely to take Cubist and or any other case that addresses 103. Seems like we've been kind of preoccupied on 101 and AIA issues recently over the last couple of years, and that's kind of flown under the radar a little bit. Just your thoughts on that.
Yeah, so I think it's a really good question, and that, you know, if you look at decisions by the Patent Office, 95% of the decisions by the Patent Office are on the question of obviousness. Obviousness is the core to patentability, and it comes up all the time. Most people who think they have a new invention, actually do have something new, and the question is it a significant enough advance beyond what's happened before? And so this is a really important issue, and we want to get it right. The Supreme Court decided, I think it was 2007, the KSR decision that essentially made it easier to reject pending applications or to invalidate patents on the grounds of obviousness. But the Cubist case, I think, is really interesting. And in that case, if I'm remembering correctly, it involves secondary indicia of non-obviousness. And these are essentially objective factors that might provide kind of circumstantial evidence that an invention is actually an invention. And the problem here for patentees is that the Federal Circuit, like it has done in these other areas we've talked about, has created a set of strict limitations on when that kind of evidence can be presented and when it's relevant to the question. And the patentee is asking the Supreme Court to say, hey, hold on here. This is supposed to be a flexible test, and so we shouldn't have these kind of rigid limits. And so it's really fascinating. I think it's a little too early. I think that petition was filed quite recently, and so generally we have to look to see is there going to be amicus support, what's going to happen with that, and so it's a little unclear for me to make any kind of analysis, and as far as I know, I think that's the only obviousness case pending before the court right now.
Thank you all very much for joining us today. Our next scheduled teleforum call will be next Friday, April 15th at 2 p.m. It'll be a conversation about religious liberty in the armed forces. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank Professor Crouch, Mr. Beeney, and Mr. Hellman for joining us today. We welcome your feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Please join us for our next teleforum next Friday, April 15th at 2 p.m. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.